Why So Much Suffering by Robert C. Newman. A brief abstract of the talk. Atheists commonly object that an all-powerful, perfectly good God would not allow suffering, or at least not as much suffering as we see. We respond by considering these questions. 1. Is there a God? 2. Is he the God of the Bible? 3. Is he loving? 4. Why then is there suffering? 5. Why so much suffering? One of the usual objections to the existence of the God of the Bible is the problem of suffering. It goes like this. If God is all-powerful, he's able to stop suffering, isn't he? If God is perfectly righteous, he would stop suffering, wouldn't he? But we see suffering, don't we? So, either God is not all-powerful, or he isn't perfectly righteous, or he doesn't exist. The author of Atheism in the Encyclopedia of Philosophy takes this to be the strong argument, the strongest argument against the existence of God. This argument has had varying levels of impact among various people, but take, for instance, the impact of this argument among Jewish people. Many Jewish people say this is the reason they gave up believing in God, that a good, all-powerful God would not have allowed the Holocaust. Rabbi Harold Kushner, on the other hand, gives up the idea that God is all-powerful. He's doing the best he can. Well, we think that the God who exists is all-powerful and perfectly righteous, and yet there is a reason for the suffering. Here's our approach. We're going to ask, first of all, is there a God? And then, is this God the God of the Bible? And is he loving? And why then is there suffering? And why so much suffering? First, is there a God? We suggest there is, and that there is some powerful evidence for it, some of which has become more apparent in recent years. One of these is evidence for a created universe. Cosmology strongly points to a universe with a beginning. Associate friend of mine, Hugh Ross, who has a doctorate in astronomy, says that the history of cosmology in the 20th century was a ever more frantic attempt to avoid a beginning in the face of mounting evidence for the same. We discussed some of this in our PowerPoint talk, The Cosmos and the Bible. We also see that this universe is strikingly designed, what's often been called the anthropic principle, or fine-tuning. We discuss some of this evidence in Cosmos in Contact, evidence for a mind behind the universe, if you like. There's not only the evidence for a created universe, there's evidence for created life. The simplest life is complex enough that the universe couldn't have made it on its own. We look at this a little bit in our PowerPoint talks. The origin of life. Computer viruses, artificial life, and the origin of life. Computer simulations of evolution. I think that's mainly where we discuss those particular points. Life is astonishingly organized, far beyond the ability of mutation and natural selection to explain this. We look at that a little bit in our PowerPoint talk, the creation-evolution debate, recent developments, and in our talk, computer simulations of evolution. So here we're just sketching what the topics are, and we discuss them in considerably more detail in these other PowerPoint talks. Our conclusion here, yes, there is a God, the creator and designer of the universe. Is this God the God of the Bible? Yes, I think there's good evidence for that as well. I would look, first of all, at the evidence from fulfilled prophecy, evidence from prophecies about the nations around Israel, evidence from prophecy about Israel, evidence from prophecies about the Messiah. We discuss these in some detail in our book, evidence of prophecy. There's another book out there that you might have trouble finding called The Prophet Motive, which also discusses this in some detail. And there's some discussion in John Mark Montgomery's book, Evidence for Faith. Besides that, we have some PowerPoint talks. Not a whole lot we've done on prophecy regarding the nations. Our talk, Prophecy Ancient and Modern, does something with that. We've got a good bit on Israel in our PowerPoint talk, Israel, Evidence of God from History, and on the Messiah in our PowerPoint talk, Jesus, a Testimony of Prophecy and History, and the PowerPoint talk, They Saw Jesus Centuries in Advance. Besides the evidence from Fulfilled Prophecy, there's the evidence for Changed Lives. Millions of individuals through history have had their lives transformed by coming to know Jesus. And this, in fact, is a huge feature of books that you will find in Christian bookstores, personal testimonies of transformed lives. I haven't done much reading in those particular directions, so I'm not sure I can give you lots of examples of that sort. Chuck Colson's Born Again would be a one example of that, but there are lots and lots of those. Something that is very strong contrast with Judaism, or Islam, or Hinduism, or Buddhism, where you will not find that kind of material. Not only do we have evidence from changed lives, we have evidence from changed societies. this is sketched for us in a number of books. I think of the one by D. James Kennedy, What If Jesus Had Never Come? The book by Alvin Schmidt, I believe it is. Can we get the name of that? Under the Influence, that's the name of it. And also, InterVarsity has a book out, What Has Christianity Done for Us? So, changed individuals, changed societies. Well, we spend a moderate amount of our time in my course on Christian evidences discussing some of this material as well. My conclusion from all of this is, yes, the God who exists is the God of the Bible. Well, what do we know about the Bible's God? Well, the Bible pictures God as all-powerful. The Bible pictures God as perfectly righteous. The Bible indicates that evil and suffering exist. In fact, the Bible indicates that evil and suffering will always exist, but that one day they will be confined to a popular term, hell, a more technical term, the lake of fire, after the last judgment. So, this objection that has been raised certainly is one that would apply to the Bible's God. Is God loving? Well, that's going to depend on someone's definition of love. Some people define love so that it will never, under any circumstances, allow suffering. If that's so, then the God of the Bible is not loving by this definition. But this definition doesn't work even for real human love. In parenting in recent years, there's been an emphasis on tough love, that real love doesn't avoid suffering for the kids under every circumstance, etc. What is biblical love? Well, we have Paul's description in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, and in verses 4 through 7 there he says, love is patient, kind, not envious, not boasting, not proud, not rude, not self-seeking, not easily angered, doesn't keep records, doesn't delight in evil, rejoices with the truth, always protects, trusts, hopes, perseveres. Well, I believe God is loving in this sense. Well, that brings us back to our original question. Why then is there suffering? God is all-powerful. God is perfectly righteous. God is able to stop suffering. But he doesn't stop all suffering. Well, if all these other things are true, apparently then he must have perfectly good reasons for allowing suffering to occur and to continue. The question arises, what might these reasons be? Well, we may be able to understand some of the reasons by thinking about certain ways of viewing God. Think about viewing God as a parent. A righteous God must punish evil. Well, parents have to punish evil as well. Parents sometimes do this in punishing evil in their children by direct action, spanking or rebuking or penalizing in some way. Sometimes they let events take their course. Suffering is often needed to encourage maturity. So parents, good parents, gradually let up on control of their children so that the child comes to make more and more of its own decisions. They gradually let up on protection so that the child learns that their actions have consequences. The parents let up on punishment gradually so that the child does right for the right reasons. So here are a number of ways in which we might see that God as a parent allows suffering to occur. Think about God as creator. This isn't particularly a model, as it, we might think of it in parent or an analogy, but it does give us some reasons to think about the whole question of suffering. God has created a world of cause and effect. And in a world of cause and effect, the action of sinners, rebels, wicked people, are going to cause suffering to themselves and to others. Without such a system of cause and effect, there's really no way to experience how bad evil is. So, in some sense, if God has once decided to create a world of cause and effect, then suffering will be one of the natural consequences of that in the presence of rebels and wicked people. Other models of God can be proposed. Take one that seems to be a rather common one, though perhaps not regularly expressed, and that is God as hotel keeper. Here, if everything is not going just right with our lives, then God is not doing his job. Just like if you pay $150 for a hotel room one night, you expect the beds to be made, the floor to be clean, and all of those sorts of things, and you rarely complain if it is not. But maybe God is not a hotel keeper. How about the model of God as novelist? Can a novelist be a good person and have bad characters in his novel? Can a good novelist have even the good characters in his novel experience suffering? Well, I would certainly say yes. Two of my favorite novels are Tolkien's Lord of the Rings and Lewis's Narnia Chronicles. And in both of those, you have bad characters, and you have good characters who experience suffering. What purposes might a novelist have for including evil and suffering? Well, it depends on what kind of novelist you're thinking about, I suppose. Some novelists might have that because they think that'll make money, sell books better. Other novelists might have it because they're trying to provide entertainment, and they think evil and suffering in a novel might be entertaining. Still other novelists might want to give the reader vicarious experience. Certainly experiencing evil and suffering in a novel might be a little easier going than experiencing evil and suffering in life. Another reason might be helping the reader to learn about life. So those are purposes a novelist might have for including evil and suffering. Some of those might be things that a good novelist might do, and some of them might not be things that a good novelist would do, or at least would not be prime purposes. What purposes might God have for allowing evil and suffering? Well, I think we'd learn a little something from the book of Job, from a passage in Ephesians chapter 3, namely verse 10. And from Matthew 13, 44 through 46. Let's have a look at each of these rather quickly. The book of Job has, at least as one of its major themes, the question of whether we serve God for who he is or for what we can get out of it. The charge which Satan makes against Job is that he serves God for what Job is going to get out of it, and basically God allows the test so that we see in the end that in fact Job serves God for who God is. Another theme of the book of Job might be, how do we respond to calamity in our own lives? So we get some ideas perhaps here of purpose of God. God allows this particular suffering in Job's life as a test, not so that God will learn something, but a test so that Job will learn something, and Satan will at least see something, whether he will learn anything from it or not, whether he'll make good use of it, so that Job's friends will see some things. You see something of the sort in Ephesians 3:10, where the Apostle Paul says his intent, God's intent, was that now through the church, the manifold wisdom of God should be known, made known to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly realm. That somehow what is happening in church history, what is happening among believers, is something that demonstrates the diversity of God's wisdom to who? To supernatural beings of some sort. Unfallen angels, fallen angels. We're not told exactly who these rulers and authorities in the heavenly realms are. Matthew 13:44-46. Jesus' parable of the hidden treasure and the pearl of great price. Jesus says, the kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy he went and sold all that he had and bought that field. Quick little short parable there, but basically picture somebody who's perhaps a day laborer or a tenant farmer working in a field, and he comes across a treasure, perhaps a plowing, and the plow strikes something, and he gets down, and it's a clay pot, and it's filled with gold or silver. Well, he realizes that if he carts this into town, that people will immediately want to know where it was found. And as soon as it turns up where it was found, the owner of that field will claim it because it's on his property. So the fellow hides it, and then he goes and pulls together all the money he has or can borrow, etc., and buys the field. And he's overjoyed to do that because he realizes what a treasure he's got. Verses 45 and 46 is the parable of the pearl of great price, is the traditional name. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. This parable is very much like the previous one, except the guy is looking for something, and he knows what he's looking for. The other guy wasn't looking for the treasure, though he recognized it when he found it. This guy comes across a marvelous pearl. And being a pearl merchant, he recognizes its value in a way that perhaps the guy that owns it does not. And he goes and turns into cash everything he has and buys it in order to have that. In both of these, we see a picture of somebody giving up everything they have and doing it with joy because they realize the value of what they're getting. So the picture here is that the kingdom of heaven is so valuable, it's worth going through suffering, it's worth giving up everything to have it. So that may explain then why there is suffering. Why so much suffering? Mankind is very sinful, so producing and reaping much suffering. Disaster is an advance warning of the wrath to come. Luke 13:1-9. We'll look at that in just a moment. There is superhuman evil in the world. Will there be suffering forever? See Luke 16:19-31. What about baby suffering? See John 21:21-23. So the explanation that the Bible might give is why is there so much suffering? Well, humans are very sinful, and so they produce and experience a good deal of suffering. Okay? And that there's superhuman evil in the world as well. But we want to look at these other ideas as well. Luke 13. Now, there were some present at that time who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. Jesus answered, "Do you think these Galileans were worse sinners than all other Galileans because they suffered this way? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you too will all perish. For those 18 of whom who died when the tower in Siloam fell on them, do you think they were more guilty than all the others living in Jerusalem? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you too will all perish." Then he told this parable. A man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, went to look for fruit on it, but did not find any. So he said to the man who took care of the vineyard, "For 3 years now, I've been coming to look for fruit on this fig tree and haven't found any. Cut it down. Why should it use up the soil?" "Sir," the man replied, "leave it alone for one more year, and I'll dig around it and fertilize it. If it bears fruit next year, fine. If not, then cut it down." What we have here is that Jesus' attention is called to some incident which we don't otherwise know anything about, in which the Roman governor of this territory had killed some Galileans, presumably while they were in its temple making sacrifices. And we don't know much about it, but I suspect that the governor figured that they, or though he probably got their families too, that they were rebels, and that this was the way to get them, if you like. And Jesus does not suggest that these guys who suffered this were worse sinners than others, but he suggests that unless we repent, we will similarly perish, suggesting that these people died as a warning to others who didn't die. You get the same thing from Jesus picking this other example, which is more what we might think of as a accident or a calamity, or what the insurance agencies used to call an act of God, perhaps an earthquake that brought a tower down in the southern part of Jerusalem, Siloam. And the ones who died weren't more guilty than the others living, but unless you repent, you too will all perish. Well, he justifies his answer in the parable that follows, the parable of the fruitless fig tree, basically that a farmer plants fig trees to have figs. This one wasn't giving them. Why shouldn't he cut it down? And the gardener says, "Give it one more chance. I'll put special fertilizer around it, etc., and give it one more chance." The response then that Jesus is suggesting here is that when disasters occur, we are perhaps do better to ask, "Why didn't it happen to me?" And to that we can give an answer. The answer is, you're being given another chance to respond to God properly. Well, that's Luke 13. Luke 16 is this one that deals with the question about, will there be suffering forever? Here, Jesus is telling a story of two men, a very wealthy man who is unnamed, and a very poor man who has perhaps died of starvation or died of sickness, some sort of sores on his body, who is named Lazarus. And we pick up the story here when they both died in hell, where he was in torment, the rich man. He looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. So he called him, "Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water. Cool my tongue because I'm in agony in this fire." But Abraham replied, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things. But now he's comforted here and you're in agony. And besides all us, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us." He answered, "Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my father's house." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them." "No, Father Abraham," he said, "but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent." He said to them, "If they do not listen," said to him, "if they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, they won't be convinced even if someone rises from the dead." Well, I bring this up here because it suggests that this fellow, unnamed former rich fellow, is still sinning, even while he is, well, he's not in hell in the sense of the final eternal state. He's in what theologians call the intermediate state, but here the NIV translates it hell. It's Hades, and he's still sinning. And so perhaps the part of the explanation for the eternality of hell is that those who wind up there are those who've turned down God's only remedy for sin. And since they've turned down the remedy, God leaves them to continue to sin. But once the last judgment has occurred, he cannot continue to postpone their punishment. So this person is continuing to sin and continuing to be punished forever. Scary picture. John 21:21. Is the one I put back there in the previous panel. What about baby suffering? Okay. And if you read this passage, it doesn't say a thing about babies. John 21:21. Jesus has just given a rather cryptic prediction of what's going to happen to Peter. He's going to, when he is old, he's going to stretch out his arms and someone else will dress him and take him where he doesn't want to go. And John, looking back on that, sees that that was a prediction about how Peter was going to die. He was going to have his arms stretched out in crucifixion, etc. And but back at this point, when just after Jesus made this prediction, Peter sees John and says, "Lord, what about him?" Jesus answered, "I want him to remain alive until I return. What is that to you? You must follow me." Because of this, the rumor spread among the brothers that his disciple would not die. But Jesus did not say he would not die. He only says, "I want him to remain alive until I return. What is that to you?" Here we see essentially that Jesus is saying, Peter, it's none of your business what's going to happen to John. And in some sense, that's the case with the babies. It's none of our business what's going to happen to the babies. God can run the universe without our help. God is more merciful than we are. God is more loving than we are, and God will do the right thing, whatever that turns out to be. A last thing to say about this whole question of suffering is that God suffers too. In Isaiah 63:9, Isaiah says, "In all their afflictions, in all of Israel's afflictions, he, God, was afflicted." God suffers with Israel in their afflictions. We see something similar in Acts 9:4-9, where the Apostle Paul, this is back at his conversion before he was an apostle, is stopped by Jesus on the road to Damascus, and he sees this light, bright light from heaven, and hears this voice, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" Well, think of Jesus being safe in heaven, and Paul is Saul is just persecuting Christians. The picture? That when people persecute Christians, they're persecuting Jesus. See the same idea in Matthew 25, where the king, Jesus, at his return, will say to those on his left and those on his right, those who did and didn't help poor people and such, "Inasmuch as you did or didn't do it to the least of these, you did or didn't do it to me." Jesus counts as done or not done to him those things that we do or don't do to people, the poor people, the people who need us. Some conclusions then. God apparently has good reasons for allowing suffering. I'm not sure we know what all of them are, and we certainly don't know how to parse all of what is going on in history. That's certainly another one of the lessons of the book of Job, is that Job and his friends had hardly a clue on what was really going on as they saw Job there suffering, because they couldn't see the other half of the story. They couldn't see what was going on in the unseen world. God apparently has good reasons for allowing suffering, though I do not claim to know them all. More practically, we need to ask, what are we doing to relieve suffering? Doubtless one purpose of allowing suffering is that it allows people to do good by reaching out and trying to help people who are suffering. Third point, we should seek to avoid eternal suffering and to help others to avoid eternal suffering also. What are we doing in both of those areas? And lastly, God has suffered more than anyone else to save us from such eternal suffering. The film, The Passion, gives us a little feeling of the physical suffering that Jesus went through to save us from eternal suffering. But there's no way in a film to do a justice to the mental, the emotional suffering that Jesus went through in being abandoned by his Father. And that goes far beyond the mere physical suffering. Well, that's the end of our talk. And my suggestion here with the problem of suffering, you can escape suffering, and you can help others to do so as well. I pray that by God's grace, you might do both these things.